But speaking of tone, I fully enjoyed. I mean, I have set aside. You know, it's like if we're reading. I just find this to be true. If we're reading this repeatedly, like consistently, I don't get my allergy to his sense of authenticity kind of dissipates, and it just doesn't. I note it in places, and then I just like, yeah, whatever, and move on.
Heidegger.
But like, yeah, for Heidegger. But I mean, this is like these chunks I thought were fantastic. Like I really. And I was reading them faster than I would like to just because I've had a crazy week and I was doing it this morning and was like, God, I wish I had more time with this because it's just very, very careful.
Mm-hmm.
And although careful is a weird word there because it's also, I mean, he uses the word, you know, care, but it's also like, it's just, so I'm making this mental connection between Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals, the third book, where he has a series of repetitions of the refrain of about the what is the meaning of the ascetic ideal,
yeah.
And that question mutates throughout the course of that book. And I swear, like I have not finished this book, so we've got three more lectures left, and all these lectures are a collection of series of quotes, like. This quote gets you to and spend time with this quote for several lectures, and it moves you to another quote and spend time with that quote for several lectures, and it moves you to another quote. And I'm so hoping he doesn't tie it together. Like, I'm so nervous that at the end he's going to say, so this is the final meaning of what is called thinking, or what calls
I mean, given
thinking.
What we just read, that would be really hard to do. Although I will say that The one that is probably the refrain for the book is the, you know, that which is most thought provoking, that which gives us food for thought, and just right. Frankly, you know, what is called thinking. And one thing I've loved about these lectures is, I mean, it took me, you know, several lectures for this to start happening, but now every time I read that, what is called thinking, I am getting at it in a different sense. It has sort of opened up a little bit, and I'm able to engage and explore it differently, more. I think that's very nice because, you know,
I agree.
The clumsiness of that syntax, you know, what is called thinking, just right. Threw me. But you know, I'm really enjoying those, you know, the ruminations.
It is ruminating, and in this case, it's the only time that I can think of in Heidegger that I've read in Heidegger at least, where he really walks us through his creative etymology.
Yeah.
Like with the legend, like, I mean, those series of the Parmenides sentence, right? Sort of translation of the Parmenides sentence. He really slowly walks us through like each of the words and why he's, you know, like not going with the conventional interpretation and why, you know, and the relationship between his you know, the true speaking of something in its essence and the commonplace, like it's just much slower. He doesn't just do the wacky interpretation let it stand. He actually sort of walks through the process of making the interpretation or the translation that he wants, and it's really I thought great. Like I was just like, okay, I get it. I get, you know, why you want to make this move and why you insist on these terms and why, and like there's one of my favorite moments is when he translates thinking as perceiving, and then he says, this is on 203. So we're getting now to the thinking word, and he says we're going to translate this as perceiving. Yet nothing is gained if in this translation we now replace thinking with perceive, as long as we do not become involved in what that indicates. In other words, like. So just shifting the term from one term to another doesn't do what's necessary or what he's trying to do, that one still has to spend time with and ruminate, I think is exactly the right word, like ruminate on, you know, why perceiving isn't passive, it's active, you know, the stuff that he goes on to say. But it's just the sort of, you know, I feel like I've said that so many times with students, it's like, you don't get out of a problem by replacing it with a different concept. Like you still have to, that's a move and it's an important move, but you don't like, oh, now we're talking about hybrids or now we're talking about relations rather than objects, right? Like that doesn't solve the problem. You still have to live with the notion of relations and show why relations are not just some what that which happens between objects, right? For example.
What I love what he's doing here is showing that the vast majority of what we call thinking, which is usually answering questions or solving problems, is precisely a flight from the anxiety or the difficulty of engaging or involving oneself with a problematic. Yeah. And finding some internal problematic or some external term that is going to fix it. And fix it in both in two senses. Like one, make it static and knowable, and then two, solve the problem.
Answer the question. Right.
Like I've made it to the holy land, right? Like I don't want to wander in the desert anymore. I've made it to the holy land. We found our, hybrid networked ecologies, and we know the answer is sustainability. That one's for you, Thomas.
The same move that he makes with perceiving, he does with the word problematic, where he says it's a problem that problematic is the essence of the habitat, the unique habitat and locus of thinking. But in view of the rashness of our public, let us know something else. It may easily happen that soon, even tomorrow, the slogan is promulgated. Everything depends on the problematic, and every statement and it's like. So just as he said, the problematic, that's where the answer lies. It's like, but no, that's not where, like, as a simple statement. So it is what's necessary is the rumination, the movement, the inhabitation. I mean, those are the different sort of terms. Nietzsche's is rumination, but yeah.
You can't sloganize the problematic. Like, and that was a really interesting, that was just like one or two sentences there, right, where he talks about that. Yeah. But that was interesting to me because I was thinking about, especially the early iterations of my project, where I was like, you have to dwell in the problematic as opposed to offering sort of tidy solutions. And while I think that is basically correct, I mean, like as a philosophical or theoretical impulse, or even just an impulse pedagogically in any context, I think that is kind of like, that would be my inclination, right? Is to dwell in the complexity of a series of problems, interrelated problems, rather than pushing for some sort of utopian solution.
Right.
But Heidegger here is saying precisely like, if that's all you say,
right,
like, that's becoming another brand.
That's another slogan.
Yeah.
Like
you
have to always dwell in the problematic. It's like, well, that, it has lost the force,
lost a very particular kind of force that, if the slogan becomes, dwell in the problematic, then insofar as you feel safe and comfortable doing that, I think that there is a kind of like essential, suffering is probably not the right word, but a certain central anxiety that, one has to, if it makes sense to become comfortable with discomfort. I like the way that he brings that up with Kant on 179 toward, and this is sort of like, look, the very easy way of taking up that, that phrase, being is to either say, look, there's nothing valuable here that offers up no food of thought. Being is basically tautological. And, maybe the most interesting thing you can say about it is that it has become tautological because, here in the middle of 179, because thinking itself has slowly become accustomed to the idea which the sentence states. In other words, this sort of like what is radically new for Parmenides just sort of becomes commonplace in, history of Western languages. And then he turns to Kant to say that, Kant's like basically that there's nothing analyzable about this concept of being, that you just have to take it as sort of like a first, brute fact. And he claims that it's the work of the concept that allows him to do this. Mm-hmm. This is the very last, line of that last full paragraph on 179. Kant's judgment that being belongs among the almost unanalyzable concepts is indeed fully justified once we share his assumption that what the words being and existence designate can be grasped primarily and only in a concept. The concept, literally with, that prefix con there as sort of, inscribing boundaries around the thing and in order to be able to domesticate it. And of all things, you would think that in some ways, like being and his relative staticness would lend itself to domestication, as opposed to say like becoming.
Right, because but you can imagine it would be totally in the spirit of the Heideggerian thinking to say, you know, the equation of the concept with grasping is a poor understanding of grasping, because grasping is not simply a container, it is a fitting, right? Yeah. Like to grasp something means you have to have a handhold or what, you know what I mean? Like one could imagine doing that work of saying, like taking that a different, one turn further. And it's really, I mean, it's kind of interesting here because it's like, I've always sort of thought, you know, hey, look, the kind of questions that we're interested in are ones that just don't have answers, right? There aren't something as simple as answers. But I feel like Heidegger is saying something more important than that, which is they can't have answers. It's important that they don't. It's not just that they don't happen to. It's that anything that takes the function of an answer ends the thinking. Mm-hmm. And so for thinking to become involved, it has to be an inquiry that's directed and is a search, but literally cannot, right? Like an answer would fuck it up, right? Like the moment that you feel like, ah, I got it, you're always looking for that moment. You're always searching to come to the like, ah, the epiphany or something. But once you have the epiphany, you've got to keep, because that's what thinking is. Thinking is not the uncovery of the essence. Right. It is the constant production of the uncovering. And you're like, that to me is that's a different step, right? Yeah. Like it's not just that these are unanswerable questions, it's that it's like intellectually important that you not think you have answers.
And we had this conversation. Oh, go ahead, Nate.
I was just going to say that might be his departure from Kant here as well, because even in Kant's bracketing of the noumenal or of being, right? That there's a certainty in that bracket, right? It's like we constitutively cannot answer the question of being because the concept gets in the way.
Right.
And that's a yes or no. That's like a definitive claim of Kant's, right? We cannot do this. We cannot grasp the thing in itself. And whereas Heidegger is obviously interested in intervening at that point differently than Hegel is, but like
only if you think grasping and concepts are about representation.
Right. Right.
You know,
and here so it's important.
He's right.
That, you know, he's like, look, this is that, I mean, this comes out of work that is prior to the Critique of Pure Reason. And I mean, like, Critique of Pure Reason is only able to get up on the ground by saying the noumenal is inaccessible. And I need to feel confident that the noumenal is inaccessible so that I can clear a space to do the work on, you know, the logic of the faculty. Yeah, exactly. It is a totally fundamental way of changing what thinking is. Because, I mean, like, the very schemata in which thinking is placed is always, you know, predicated on the telos of solving or answering. Is that, you know, if thinking is, insofar as, you know, the phrase thinking as a way of life gets taken up, is that, like, it's always the next problem I'm going to solve. And then I'm going to catalog all of my answers and catalog all of the knowledge. And, you know, like, because I'm such an insatiable thinker, you know, I can't stop. You know, it's just how, you know, who I am, essentially. So I'll find the next thing. And, you know, that is so antithetical to what Heidegger's getting at here. He's like, no, the as you said, John, you know, the answering fucks up the thinking, that, you know, that just, you know, that little storehouse of, you know, answers that you've done are only dead thinkings that you, you know, that have now effectively not, you know, they're not living anymore. And, you know, then the next way of configuring that would be that, all right, well, then that means that none of these, if they're not answerable, then that's always a failure to answer the thing, which now imports another orientation to the thing, that, you know, there is some answer in here. It's just that, you know, because, I don't know, finitude, mortality, whatever else it is, I'm never going to get there. But that's still operating on the same schemata. And the change that needs to be made is that thinking is not paratactic on life. That thinking is nothing more than a modality of life, which is to say that to dwell in thinking is just to live a particular kind of way. It's a particular kind of, you know, invention within becoming of life. Mm-hmm. That, and you know, that becomes very hard to justify in the academy because, you know, the academy is sort of like set out at solving questions and problems. And why are you going to pay somebody, you know, to literally just think if they're not advancing or getting us closer to something that we supposedly want or.
Right.
I think we say, yeah. Aha.
So that becomes the necessity, right? Like, to me, is it's important to think the movement of thinking itself as the important part of thinking, because, for instance, there are, you could also say there are lots of answers in here, right? So he's constantly establishing provisional grounds. He's offering a different interpretation of Parmenides. He's not saying one can't translate this.
Yeah.
He wants to go after the unthought, and he wants to render the unthought thinkable, right? Mm-hmm. Like an apparent, right? Let it lay before us, and so he's doing all those things, but that process is never. Completed, and it's never the right process, so that it's like it's there are answers, there have to be points where you're like, okay, I'm not going to call this into question right now, right mm-hmm. now I'm using this as my provisional background to call this other thing into question. One can then return and call that thing into question too, right? Like and as one can, but so one is always just sort of provisionally having that, like, this is a ground or a basis of unthought that is a condition for thinking here. Mm-hmm. And then that can be, you know, then you can have an inverted relationship on those things. But you're after is the whole process, right? Like mm-hmm. process.
Right, because you would have to reconfigure what you mean by those answers, which wouldn't mean that they are provisional but wrong answers. It would just mean that they are, you know,
they're
slowed
singular,
down
they're
or provisional, singular, like provisional singularities, right? That in their very activation will get unmade, not because they're not right, not because they haven't fulfilled something, right? But
because in this context, they work in this, in another context, they're going to be a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, that seems like a pretty delusion take on Heidegger here, and I'm not saying that's it wrong in any way, but I do think, like, to be a little less generous, as we have been at least here and there, like, Heidegger does seem pretty set on maybe not eternal answers that will be right regardless of the context or their application, but he is invested in it, as we've said, in a kind of authentic relation or authentic thinking or being that seems to transcend at least the moment in which he's writing, right? I mean, like, he wants to get after something that transcends the actual moment in which he's embroiled, right? That's kind of the whole goal is to reach towards something that's not where he is.
I agree with you, Nate, over and over and over again. You know, the essence, authenticity, like a sense of like the proper comes up. But that just so fundamentally flies in the face of what he really gives a lot of attention to here, in the language of, you know, translation and interpretation. And that, frankly, you know, there can be no sort of like the notion of an objective interpretation as itself a particular style of prejudice. And, you know, the kind of virtue that a notion of inaccessible answer gives you is one of humility. I have to be humble in the face of never being able to succeed. But what happens when success and failure is off of the table? It would have to give a very particular kind of confidence. Like, it would have to be a kind of confidence in arbitrary, like in a kind of arbitrariness. It's like it almost doesn't matter which path I go down as long as I articulate it to its fullest extent and follow where it takes me. And this has a whole lot to do, I think, with what he's talking about of involvement, and gets me to think of his late notion of essence completely differently.
You know, Nate wants to preserve the readings that we've been doing of Heidegger against this sort of Deleuzian sounding thing, but I want two passages here, the second of which I thought was just fucking awesome as a slogan. But the first one is right after the chunk that you just read, Nathaniel, on 192. but the time may finally have come to release language from the leash of common speech. It sounds just like the kind of thing that he was talking about there, right? And allow it to remain attuned to the keynote of the lofty statement it makes. And then this is the crucial part for me. Without, however, rating customary speech as a decline or as a low. Right? So, in other words, he's making the distinction, like there, for instance, in your case, he's making the distinction between use and utilization. So utilization would be the instrumental human sort of for me thing. And he wants to think something that's not that, without that utilization version being a negative or a declined or less authentic or less essential version. Now, I don't think he really pursues the second part of that statement nearly as much as he pursues the first part of that statement, which is, you know, refusing language or releasing language from the leash of common speech. And I don't think he really, I just don't get the sense that he really wants to own or commit to the notion of parataxis that enables, that there's a normative sense of parataxis here. At the same time, I'm with you. Like, if one hears essential nature as functionally the equivalent of the overman in Nietzsche, that's pretty interesting, right? Like, I mean, so in other words, that essential nature is the to be determined, the sense of futurity, as opposed to a retrograde reenactment of something that was there at the beginning, you know?
Right.
It would have to multiply essences, that the essential nature of something is only realized in relationship to something else. And depending on what it's in, in its activation. So depending on what it is related to would fundamentally alter its essence. And, you know, I in that language of affectivity,
Still holding on to the non-essential, non-nature that is a constitutive element of that language at the same time.
Well, I mean, you can imagine relations that aren't particularly activating, that don't particularly, that are relatively inert, right? I mean,
the virtual that hasn't been actualized.
Yeah. Which doesn't make it less real, doesn't make it, you know, lower.
Talk about turning it into Deleuze. We're literally taking the vocabulary. But I see that dynamic here. I mean, I really do, right? I see moments here where my aversion to authenticity, because literally like two pages before he says something that I wrote Yechnek to, like a speech far more primary than the most exquisitely wrought sentence. And then that's right before the using, but that doesn't mean utilization, because utilization is the instrumental human thing. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's the bad version. But then literally two pages later, he says what we just read, which is, yes, we want to release language from the leash of common language, but without rating customary language as a decline or as, you know, a low. Like, to me, if you hold on to that second part or emphasize the second part of that sentence, I mean, the second part of the sentence is there, right? Like, he's, in other words, there's good reason for saying what he refers to as essential nature is what Nietzsche talks about as futurity in the overman. Like, I think there is a way of reading it that, and it's not, and I go back and forth as we've seen throughout these, like some of these passages just seem too wedded to that notion of the proper and the essential as the sort of prior and authentic. But then there are the other places where it's like, well, that notion of authenticity actually means go do something with it, right? Go take it somewhere. And this is the one that, the passage that I'm like, I want this slogan on our t-shirts or whatever, is on 201, where Plato, in that famous passage, and this is, I mean, every part of this I think is important. Plato sees something which every thinker has to see afresh each time, else he is not a thinker. That everything that lies before us is ambiguous, right? And that, but the crucial part is it's not the slogan of everything that lies before us is ambiguous, but that every thinker has to see this afresh each time, else he is not a thinker.
Mm-hmm. How, right? Which would be to not sloganify ambiguity, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. You know, and it's like,
to make ambiguity something determinate.
Right. Like everything that lies before us is ambiguous, meaning to be determined, you know, and we'll see.
But, I mean, to me, that is, you know, I think perhaps ambiguity is his language of the overman or of, you know, interpretation in that Nietzschean sense, is that essential nature is ambiguity. And the thing that he revolted by is the calcification of ambiguity. And yeah, that, right. you know, in like the authenticity of anything is its capacity to become something else.
Right.
Yeah. And as soon as you have determined the thing, you have, that is cutting it off from its essential nature, which is literally the opposite of what we think of essence.
I agree.
Right.
There is good, and there's good reason, Nathaniel. I agree with you. There's good reason to read it that way. At times, it feels like he's leaning more towards. I mean, it's interesting, right, to me, because why am I willing to give Nietzsche this sort of leeway? And it's simply because his term for it is futurity. Like, it's always mm-hmm. about the future for him. Heidegger doesn't write about the future, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Heidegger writes about a past, and it's always a return or a kind of, mm-hmm. you know, or the terminology of essence. And I think that sort of temporal thing is why it's way harder for me to hear those mm-hmm. those dimensions, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, this whole season has been dominated by that question of authenticity.
Yeah,
and it is just something that has agitated all of us. We're like, we all range from wanting to dismiss it because of it or kind of seeing that, you know, something else is going on here that, you know, I mean, talk about like, you know, taking on someone's quest of trying to, you know, something that Heidegger seems quite confident about, and we're like forcing ourselves, like, well, man, I don't know about that confidence. Like, but I also want to, you know, steer away from just instinctively, you know, rejecting it either. But sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's all good. I mean, I don't know why I'm playing the foil today. I mean, I feel like usually it's John or whatever, but like with the kind of critique of Heidegger. But the only thing, because I agree with you, all your points about essence, you could refigure it as a word for the overman or as a word for a Nietzschean interpretation. I completely agree. I just think that Heidegger tends to like fetishize that destabilized space a little bit.
Yeah,
like
that's right.
It becomes like, so the ambiguity that he's after is obviously really interesting, and he articulates it in ways that are kind of confounding and whatever, and it's cool. But I feel like this is why I kind of lean back to Hegel, because Hegel is diagnostic of the tendency, like you said earlier, Nathaniel, to calcify ambiguity. Right, so that calcification, which is the enemy of Heidegger's, he wants to get so far away from that that he ends up fetishizing the alternative a little bit, where it's like, that's why he goes towards the poetic as an alternative to logos, etc. And it's not like that's a problem in itself. It's just that he seems to be reaching for something that for me it's a little bit out of reach, or it's not that it's inaccessible or whatever. It's just
That's clearly a risk, but that risk would be exactly the risk of sloganizing or calcifying the ambiguous itself, is to, you know, sort of like get yourself to the ambiguous clearing and then staying there without actualizing any sort of line of flight would precisely be the problem. And this is, again, like where it comes back to a strange kind of confidence, you know, this is, I mean, Heidegger isn't imperial or authoritarian in the way that we discovered that Hegel is, but he does have a weird kind of brash confidence in stuff that we're sometimes like, did you really substantiate that? And, you know, it is nice in these few lectures where he really, really does show the work of doing the substantiation. But, you know, it is a way of showing that if you're going to take this ambiguity stuff seriously, you need to make things with the ambiguity. As long as you're clear that whatever you make is going to get undone and remade, then cool. But you can't just stay in the ambiguity. You have to make something with it to produce the new ambiguity.
I mean, I think that I totally agree with that. And if one did, like what Boo Boo is saying, like the simple realization of ambiguity being the case would not be a thinker seeing it afresh each time. Right. Yeah. That would be like, you know, that would just be like, okay, well, that's the sort of fetishizing of like, hey, it's indeterminate. Yeah. Right. And so the seeing it afresh is like, I got to fucking make something from, you know, I have to, like, it's ambiguous in its essence. That means I have to hook it to something and make something out of it, which of course will itself then be ambiguous, but that's the sort of movement of life, right?
Like, and you have to continue to characterize that ambiguity each time. You have to not to represent it, but you have to kind of key into it somehow each and every time. Rather than simply like designating it.
It's not a state. You're not simply recognizing a state of affairs that is ambiguity, right?
Which would lend itself to like temerity or again, humility. Right. But it's like, this is like the difference between, you know, he talks about faith as being the enemy of thinking. You know, there's like a difference between a faith or an assurance in what one has made and a confidence. It's like, I'm going to confidently follow this thing that I am making full. And part of that confidence is not in antithesis, like not, you know, in opposition to that confidence, but part of that confidence is knowing that it is not a bedrock, that it is only a provisional, you know, point of traction that will undo itself and,
I think there's a different sense of what Nate brings up that I do want to hang on to, which is that, you know, the sentence that I pointed to, which is without denigrating the common, you know, without rating customary speech as a decline, it's just not a point of emphasis for him. That second part, right? He says it there, but like, for instance, why not? I mean, why not just say things in incredibly determined, calcifying ways?
That part's like, absent, yeah.
Right, like,
but he does. But he does do that with his
that's
etymology.
The style. Yeah, I mean, and honestly, like, that's my style question. It's like they're just different ways of inhabiting the sort of calcification, deterritorialization. Like, they're just different ways.
It is an odd qualification though, because he doesn't say that really anywhere else, and I didn't catch that on my reading. Like the part you pointed out where he kind of allows for the common speech to even just exist. Like, in other places, he's very...
I agree with you.
Just denigrating of it.
It's not common for him to rate common speech as not being less than or a failure or a falling away from. I mean, I agree with
you. He does. There are a handful of mentions.
There are places. Okay. There are
places. In the previous lectures. And then even here, you know, like, he does the... He wants to make sure that there's, like, he wants to eschew a kind of progressivism, right? I mean, with paratactic syntactic, right? He wants to say that, like, wine isn't, you know, the wine parataxis is not simply, you know, a stage on the way to syntax.
Syntax.
And that, you know, the pre-Socratics are just not a way, like, he's, you know, these aren't developmental steps. And he doesn't even want to say, like some primitive language is, you know, like the primitiveness of it isn't some sort of like underdeveloped notion of, some other refined thing. So, you know, that, to me, that, I mean, that is it cut from the same cloth as that, as that claim. I mean, what I do think maybe the location here is some kind of conscious, like raising consciousness, raising that, you know, mere utilization is a problem when you have faith that you have, you know, done the work, and then that somehow makes it less inventive. And I think your intervention, John, is like, that makes it no less, the fact that you don't know that you're being inventive and the fact that you, you know, think that you have found the right answer in no way, shape, or form makes it any more or less inventive.
This is where, like, remember, like, that What is Rhetoric essay that I wrote 20 years ago or something, where it's like, look, I mean, there are many ways of not answering the question, what is rhetoric? And one of them is answering the question, right? Because that has never stopped people from defining rhetoric. When I said, like, the final and absolute definition of rhetoric is X, it doesn't stop anyone else from defining rhetoric, right?
Yeah.
It gives them coordinates from which to offer diverging definitions. Yeah. So that, in that sense, the calcification is what enables the itinerary, right? It's not calcification versus deterritorialization. It's like, you don't have deterritorialization without a point, right?
Yeah.
You know, something from which one responds. And that point is not simply, you know, the point itself as a point is not determined. You have to then figure out what the point is in order to diverge from the point. But you
Or think about it from like evolutionary biology, that, you know, it's oftentimes the trendier thing to do is to say, look like at mass extinction events and see them as inventive catalysts.
Right.
Because, you know, because it's a deterritorialization, it's a decalcification. But then you could also say that, you know, the singularity of any sort of of, I don't know, like overdetermination of biodiversity or like stagnation or climate change, or, you know, call it the Anthropocene or whatever it is, like the particular configuration of that hypercalcification is also going to be a pretty strong influencer on, you know, say a mass extinction event or some other sort of like inventive divergence or whatever it is, right? It's going to provide the contours.
You just have these dynamics of like movement and rest, and by the way, you don't even know which is which, right? Like this is where, to me, if you really want to get into Deleuze's concept of deterritorialization and reterritorialization, you have to say they're the same fucking thing, right?
Yeah.
Like they shouldn't be two concepts; they should be one concept,
right?
Like I mean, there's
two senses of the same concept.
Two senses of the same concept.
Right? Yeah, yeah. I mean, to go back to the issue of common speech real quick, though, I mean, it seems to be like his primary concern is that we are resting in this mode of thought.
That's right.
And you need to shake those kind of conservative foundations. But you brought up, Nathaniel, like how Heidegger's actually kind of progressive in his thinking of like primitive speech versus so like paratactic versus syntax and et cetera, like pre-Socratics versus Socratics. One does not like lesser than what comes after it.
I wouldn't say he's progressive in it, but
I love the idea of Heidegger as a progressive.
He's at least conceptually.
He's progressive about his anti-progressivism.
Yeah, exactly. He's a very progressive fascist. But the issue with modern communication or with common speech, representational thinking, is not that it's primitive or that it's pre-Heideggerian, right? It's that it's like too advanced almost.
Oh, or absolutely.
It's gotten too technical.
Absolutely.
And it's too successful all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. Like, and he makes the admission, like, we wouldn't have automobiles. We wouldn't have this technology without this kind of thinking. It's created a series of problems in its own right, like sort of secondary or whatever, like residual issues with this type of thinking.
Right, so but the difference is, for Heidegger, then he says, and one of the problems is it's made thinking really difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As opposed to, here's another way of taking it, it's made thinking possible for the first time.
Yeah.
Right? That other claim, like, in other words, because he wants to, there is this sense of, like, thinking was more possible and available, although there's these moments where he says, right, like, it was available prior to the representationalification of language and thinking. Like, prior to that, something was sort of available that has lost its availability and now requires a labor to make it available again. But you could say,
but if that labor that is thinking...
Right, that calcification is what enables Heidegger to be possible, right? Not because he's getting behind it, you know, you know, historically or etymologically or whatever, but because like that's the condition for like that calcification is the thing that allows for a jumping off to an uncalcified, quote unquote uncalcified,
or to, you know, just to switch the metaphor a little bit away from bones and more toward knots and ropes, is that, you know, the only way that you're going to be able to start like following the Gordian knots or sort of, you know, like following the twists and turns of the thing is for the knot to get tied in the first place. If everything is, you know, sort of like open and ambiguous and pure potentiality, then there's nothing to reactivate. There's nothing to activate differently. There's nothing to sort of
And he kind of says that about the Greeks, right? That they lived with this the sort of like the seed of this becoming in their language, in their being, but they didn't have any way to articulate
it. They didn't conceptualize it, right?
Yeah, they couldn't conceptualize their moment or their way of relating, but they were relating differently.
That's right. It was their milieu. Here's one way of saying all that we're saying. It is useful for the rock to have shafts and for the earth furrows. It would be without welcome, without stay. That's the Holderin moment. But that's what it's saying, right? Like rocks have cracks, right? Like, and it is useful, and that is welcoming. I mean, I think that that's, you know, these hard things have. But now he wants to emphasize the shafts, the cracks in the rock are the thing that's cool. You know, it's like, well, no, what about saying the rock? Without the fucking rock, you wouldn't have a shaft, right?
Yeah.
Like, so it's just, it's a question of, that's where, to me, it really is a style question of where's the emphasis? What's the primary? Is the emphasis on change, transformation, and movement, or is it on stasis, even momentary and provisional? You know, stasis, solidity, stability.
Yeah.
And again, the problem consistently is not to think those things as opposed relations, right? To say like, look, you only get the movement with the stasis. I mean, you only get the shaft with the rock. There is no shaft without a rock.
I mean, this is where you kind of, I don't know if this is going to be that quick. It'll be quick enough. You can get to your point, but it's just
take the time.
I feel like Foucault and anybody who basically takes up Nietzsche in a way that's anti-Hegelian, they do this thing where, and it's really interesting, and it's like almost the pinnacle of anti-Hegelian discourse, where you have an ontological, I guess you could say, deadlock, where for Hegel, right, like subjectivity is a constitutive condition and it has all of these constraints to it, right? Like, so like we talked about the understanding and stuff like that, how it calcifies, it appropriates, it does all these sort of rigidifying, reducing, simplifying relations. And that's the bad guy for most of post-structuralism, for Nietzsche and all that. So what they try to do and successfully and interestingly is they impose or superimpose like an ethical demand into an ontological deadlock.
Yeah, right.
So there's an impossibility like threshold there that's just continuously interrogated, right? Yeah. Over and over again in Nietzsche and Foucault and in Heidegger. And it's that tension, right, that seems to produce all of this scholarship as opposed to like stifle it.
If it's a tension, right? Like that's exactly what I'm saying. Like that's the dialectical framing.
Right. Right.
I was going to say, Nate, the only thing I learned from the Hegel tapes might be that no one has ever been anti-Hegelian.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can be. I mean, plenty of people have claimed to be anti-Hegelian.
Well, they can claim
they can claim anything they want, but as soon as you run that anti-line, you are just churning out the Hegelian machine.
There's an obvious irony there, yeah. Yeah, you get caught right as immediately when you say it, you're caught. But I don't know. I don't think it makes... My point is not that there's like naivete in the effort to make this kind of ethical or conceptual demand on Hegel's ontology. To try to get past it is pretty noble, I would think. It's obviously extremely difficult.
I think someone like Derrida, for instance, has no interest in getting past it, and it would critique the very effort to try to get past it. You know, there is no getting past that knot.
Well, getting past, I guess, Derrida is certainly interested in something different from
yes and no, right? Like it's different, but not different from, right?
Right.
Like,
I think there's many Derridas too. It's like this is why I want to read that. This is why I want to read that essay, because the Restricted to General Economy essay, at least when I scanned it the first time, it seems very like post-Hegelian. Like almost explicitly, like the restricted economy is Hegelian. What I'm offering is a general economy. So it almost, and I'm not saying it's not like some vulgarization.
That's right. You're right. No, that's true. That's my reading of it.
So
I mean,
he is offering something else. Whether it's structurally opposed to the dialectic is up for question. But
But whether or not that something else is unavailable in Hegelianism, I mean, again, the difference would be, again, like. Hegel can become the thinker of absolute contingency, right? And so anything can be, right? But the point, I take the crucial point there is that the thinker has to see it afresh, see the ambiguity afresh each time, which is to say, I take this from like Deleuze's In Thousand Plateaus, where he says, multiplicity is a constructivism. It's not the ontological case.
Yeah.
It's not like shit's multiple.
Yeah.
It's that multiplicity has to be made, right? It has to be produced. So it's not, in a sense, you'd say there is no ontological claim here.
Right.
Or the ontological claim is performative or asignifying, which is it has to get made. Now, what gets made is ineluctably multiplicity, regardless, right? Our affirmation in the Nietzsche register, that's what gets made. But it's not just there. And so that's that hinge of like, it's ontological, or that's where, you know, Daredevil called it the ontological or whatever. Yeah. It's like, it's not just that there is multiplicity or there, you know, it's that it, all that ever gets made is multiplicity and active force, but.
Right. Right.
You know.
Well, I don't want to get, I don't know why I brought up Hegel. We didn't really necessarily have to go down this line, but that's the difference then.
If I had a dime for every time he has said, I don't know why
I didn't mean to.
I didn't mean to bring up Hegel.
It's not my true
fucking own.
He usually means to.
Yeah, yeah. Usually I just mean to do it. This time I didn't mean to. But I mean, you're it's just like my project is just, and I had to write a little bit today, so I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah.
That's the difference between like Barad and Deleuze, right? Is that for Barad, now again, if you want to be generous with her, maybe there's a different reading. Yeah, yeah. But for her, there's stuff out there.
Right.
For the taking, for observing. And all you have to do is get the right coordinates and you can access the in itself. For Deleuze, that's not the case. I mean, everything is, like you said, constructed and every variable is on the same plane. But he thinks that in a way, he thinks that basic principle of the flat ontological plane with a rigor that is not available in most of these kind of like post-humanist versions of the same problem.
I agree with you, but what if you said that, and I think there's reason to read it this way, and it's been a long time since I read the Universe book, but what if you said that that ontological claim is a provisional claim, right? Which is to say, okay, for the, you know, for present purposes, let's assume that there's, the truth is out there, or, you know, that we're going to find it, and it's in relation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, relation is the place where we find it. Well, to me, you would have to undo, like, the content of the claim would have to undo the structure of how you got there,
right?
You'd have to complicate the move of, like, okay, there's a truth out there, and the truth is relationality. Well, if the truth is relationality, then it can't simply be out there.
Yeah.
Right? It can only be relational. So in other words, by the content of the thing that you find there is going to subvert the thing that drove the inquiry in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? So and I think there are good reasons to read that in Barad.
I do, like, too. I mean, because the other thing you could say is this, the truth isn't out there as relationality. The truth is out there as relations. And if you're going to think about a relation as a singular intersection point, then you're going to say, all right, then, you know, the truth is, I mean, and in some ways, like, universal, because any relationship, follow it out, and it connects to literally everything else. And so, like, you know, any particular configuration is that provisional truth that is, you know, sure it's undoing and remaking itself. But if that's what you want to call truth, you just couldn't call a truth anything that we would normally think of it as like a self-contained.
It's not an answer, right?
It's not self-contained description. Yeah, it's not a self-contained entity, and it's not a description that captures the you know that can bound one thing off from everything else. That truth would truly have to radiate, you know, infinitely.
Or the next step would be, well, of course you can claim that because it's not going to work that way anyway. So you can claim anything that you like. This is a totally, you know what I mean? Like, you could just take, you know, follow it out further. Like, yes, this is the absolute truth. Yeah. There is no possible deviation from it.
And then see what that makes, right?
Right.
All I would say is that,
I mean, I don't like that version because it usually, you know, it has a way of leading itself to genocide.
Yes, it does. Yes,
yeah,
it does.
Yeah, there's some issues with that.
That's an invention. Genocides are inventions. You know, not my style.
Again, it's a style. It comes back to the style question to me.
Yeah.
It's
like, all I would say is that Barad rarely, if ever, engages that kind of recursive interrogation of her own movement of thinking. So it's available. Like, you can make those moves that you were just talking about, John, where you kind of repurpose relationality within the context of the project. But she just doesn't do it for the most part, and she's way too confident in the mode of analysis. It's like we talked about with Heidegger. Once you say that, you know, dwell in the problematic, once you sloganize anything, it's all phenomena, it's all relationality.
Right.
It That's becomes right. not only meaningless, but like conservative. Like, it becomes a conservative
right, and we are looking for a kind of Hegelian reflexivity. I mean, you and I, we all are looking for that as this, right. You know, like, when I said, you know, you can find it in Heidegger, it's here. We're looking for evidence of that sort of self-awareness of the constitutive problem, because that allows us to like it more or dislike it less, maybe. But yeah. I'll give you an example. Last night I was talking to a grad student who's doing a thing on Barad. And Barad is use of pronouns, the here, her, they, whatever. And it's Barad and Butler. And they have both chosen to use the word they. Like, that's what they put in their little email signature thing. And she was talking about, she's like, yeah, I watched this YouTube talk that Barad gave at Duke. And it was on nonlinear time. Mm-hmm. And so she gave this talk, and she had slides and whatnot. And she said there was an asterisk on the first slide that stayed up for a while. And the asterisk said, you're going to have to excuse the totally linear quality of the presentation that you're about to see, right? Like, and it's a joke. It's to me, at least, it's super obviously a joke. But what she's doing there is recognizing the conditions for, you know, the thing that she's going to proceed to problematize. But in order to problematize it, I must proceed linearly, you know, in order to. And so to me, it's that kind of moment where I'm like, okay, cool, right? Like, you know, that makes it less disagreeable so that I'm not going to be like, performative contradiction, right? So, and at least for me, in my engagements with Barad, which was far less than yours, and, you know, I see reasons to be like, oh, yeah, I see her doing that. I see those kinds of moves occasionally that are enough. And again, for me, the stakes are different than they are for you, right? Yeah. Like, for me, in terms of my own intellectual itinerary, I just think, like, okay, the kind of work and thinking that she's doing is a generally good thing. I don't care, or a positive contribution to thinking in rhetorical studies.
Right.
Because that's just doesn't, there's isn't very much of that.
Yeah.
But I totally, but that doesn't mean that I disagree with your claim, because I don't, right? Like, I see that, yes, she's calcifying, and she is, you know, projecting a kind of positivist, right, version of this relationality being ontologically primary. I see that too. I don't think that you're wrong. Right. So it's a question, like, I get Nate wants to do that. It gives him a thing to do, and you're building something. So just make it cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I hope I'm in productive disagreement. I mean, a lot of it is pretty confrontational, mostly just with Barad now these days, though. Like, I was going to try to take that, I wanted to be confrontational with Deleuze, and then even with Foucault, when I learned that he was anti-Hegel, I was like, well, wait, I kind of like both Hegel and Foucault. Why is he pitching himself like this? And I was like, do I have to hate Foucault now? And I'm like, no, I don't have to hate Foucault.
No, you don't.
You can negotiate the relationships between kinds of things.
You got your Hegel tattoo, and you can't flash your...
right, right.
You have to stay in your territory now.
Even further, I would never want a Hegel tattoo or to fly the Hegel banner.
Right.
Right? Even though he's kind of become the centerpiece of this project... The whole notion of being like having a full throated investment, Hegelian. Right? Is at least I want it to be foreign to me, even if I am kind of like leaning Hegel. I would never like pitch Hegel as a product.
But I get that, and that is a question of identification, right? That we all negotiate. For me, for instance, it's like, at this stage of the game, I wouldn't have a problem with that because it's very clear to me that Foucault's Hegel is different than my Hegel. Right, like that's just clear.
Oh, yeah,
not because Foucault's is wrong, but because Foucault lived in a different moment and did different, you know, like, it's like, oh yeah, that's fine. So for him, Hegel was the bad guy, mm-hmm. and I understand why Hegel was the bad guy, but I have, you know, Nate via Zizek's version of Hegel and then our reading of that in my head when I'm thinking. So I'm like, actually, there's a different Hegel. Like, there's not one Hegel, right?
Exactly.
So, and that Hegel is a more interesting one. It's still one that, you know, I maintain a kind of identificatory distance from, and that's primacy of negation, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's, for me, the tone.
Right.
Like, that's the thing that I like about Nietzsche, Derrida, Deleuze, these folks who are like, there's just joy rather than labor, right? Yeah. Like, as a sort of primary emphasis. But... is it imaginable to me that in 10 years I might think differently about those relations? Entirely. Mm-hmm. Like, it's entirely imaginable. But I don't. So, you know, so that's all. Like, I can accept other people's negative relation without any, you know, it's not like, oh, well, Nate's not really thinking this through because he's sort of positioning Barad in this particular way. It's like, no, but Barad is totally susceptible to being positioned in this way. It's not wrong. It's not bad. It's not sloppy, and it's not strawman. It's none of those things. It's right. And there's also something else available.
Right. Yeah.
I was thinking, Nate, what even about just including your own asterisks in, you know, as a part of your dissertation? That's sort of like, look, I understand. I actually could, you know, I'm very tempted to write a very generous account of Barad because, you know, she's interesting in all these registers. And I think, you know, whatever. But given, you know, the line of thinking that I'm producing here, I'm going to articulate her in this way. It's not because I finally think that this is the right answer, but because it allows me to get a certain kind of traction. So, you know, what is at stake in my critique of Barad is not a dismissal of her. In fact, it is, you know, the condition of possibility for a line of thinking.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea. And because I was working on the intro today and I hadn't looked at that. It's basically like a repurposing of my proposal. And I haven't looked at my intro since I did the proposal. And it's all extremely, like, dismissive for the most
part. Now you know why we had the proposal meeting that we had.
Right. Yeah. But
it just took him 2 years to understand the proposal meeting.
Yeah. As I've continued to write, though, it's not that I've become, like, less confrontational with her text. It's just that a lot of times, like you're saying, like I could put these little conditional or qualification like remarks, and I do that. I actually do what you just said with but that's more so because I feel like I have at least a provisional relationship with them, and I will be seeing them all the time. So it's like, I need to say something here, and I mean it. It's not that I don't mean it.
Absolutely.
But I'm basically like, listen, I think your work is worth challenging. Like, that's the reason why I'm taking some of this stuff to task, because you are the most advanced theorist, some of the most advanced theorists in the field. So why can't I not? Like, I feel like it does justice to the work to critique it or to criticize it, but to get into the weeds with it. And if you confront it, what does that do? Right? Like, confront some of the presuppositions that might be, you know, underlying your work.
Why don't you write an afterword that is about, like, the question of negotiating intellectual subject position, right? Like, which is all that we're talking about. And the complexities of, like, there's part of me that thinks that the sort of, you know, John's version of this is available and I can do this, but that prevents me from having this as a hinge to do this other kind of thing. And I have a kind of aversion to what I smell as the positivism, but I sense that there's a way of complicating that positive. Because, by the way, I have the same reaction that you do, which is I smell the more than a hint of positivism in there. It just doesn't bother me.
Right.
Because that's just not the itinerary that matters to me in the context of her work. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm, you know, I don't think, well, geez, it's not there. Fucking boo-boo's making it up again. It is more just like where I am in terms of the thinking, that thing doesn't, it's not. And so to me, that's the difference, right, between you and me in that regard. Yeah. It has nothing to do with being right or wrong. It has everything to do, I got to admit him again, everything to do with like sort of how you're thinking through it, right? And so to me, that would be a fantastic afterword of like, look, one of the things that I'm negotiating here is my relationship and the sense of identity with which I connect myself and have increasingly connected myself to Hegel. And that has forced, not that one particularly, but any of them, we all do this, forces a kind of, you know, okay, so I like Deleuze, that means I'm supposed to like Foucault. Yeah. That means I'm not supposed to like Hegel. It means I, you know what I mean? Like the sense of intellectual affiliation, which lends itself to how we read the stuff and which things we're willing to be generous with and which things that we're not.
Right. You know? Kind of dispositional responses to scholarly texts, milieus, entire discourses.
That's right. And the field, right? Like the existence. So for instance, a big thing that's governing my willingness to not get irritated by that fact is my understanding of the field of rhetorical studies, which is like, I get that there's a more than a hint of positivism in there, but it doesn't bother me because she's smart as fuck and thinking through interesting questions. And I want people in the terrain that I'm concerned with, the rhetoric folks, to think like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No, that's so good. Yeah. Because I've been writing recently a lot just about that problem of, like, and it's not something you can really get behind. You almost just have to speculate sometimes, like,
right,
why people are responding in the way they are to certain texts, right, or whatever. Like, for example, Butler and Zizek have this dialogue in the joint book that they have, and they have all these pretty hostile exchanges with each other over the years.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm just like asking the question, like, why would these typically pretty careful scholars. Now, Zizek is an asshole all the time, but Butler rarely is. But, like, why are they basically getting in, like, Twitter beefs in a scholarly format? Like, what would compel them to do that? Right. And Zizek basically explains it. Like, this is a problem of identification. He's like, listen, Butler and I share so many presuppositions about how the world works, about everything, that you couldn't even list them. And so the issue is, like, we're trying to carve out our identity. And sometimes that's a hostile fucking thing to do.
Not right? sometimes, always.
Always.
Right? It's always a question of cutting off. Subjectivity is
violent.
Carving.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a distinctive self. I am not Judith Butler.
Right.
And this is, and so, yeah, it's volatile because that fucking really matters. That's exactly why, at least for me, the interest in non-recognition and disidentification becomes really important. Not knowing who you are, not being a major public figure, right? Like, not having that sense of stakes. You know, that's, to me, one of the things that Nietzsche is great on is, like, I'm going to occasionally say stupid shit about things because that way you won't fucking know where to situate me. And neither will I.
Yeah.
Right? It's at the beginning of Ecce Homo, where it's like, I won't even know how to situate myself. And that's part of the project. Like, I don't know where I, you know, find myself in the annals of philosophical history. Like, that's what compels me, because he recognized that problem a long time ago and said, I'm going to say dumb shit. Like,
to bring it back to Heidegger, when we take it this way, we must come to the point where we, in thought and inquiry, retrace the questioning of a thinker by starting from his own thinking and from nowhere else. This task differs in every respect from the frequently heard demand that we must understand a thinker in his own terms. Yeah. That is impossible, because no thinker and no poet understands himself. How then could anybody else dare claim to understand a thinker, even to understand him better? Mm-hmm. And, like, again, not as a failure, but...
Right, yeah.
So, but I love that. So basically, you should write an afterword on style.
Yeah, I should put some of that in the intro, though. You're right. Like, I just sent the intro off to Byron, because Byron was like, I want your introduction. I was like, well, I don't have it. But okay, I'll whip it up for you. But that would be good to kind of, just because that, not only does it provide some, like, what's the word? Like, some, like, leniency or, like, just some kind of qualifying remarks.
Right.
But it also reshapes kind of the whole trajectory.
The whole project.
Because the middle chapters are very much invested in that question, but the proposal, which is serving as the intro, did not explicitly articulate that. So, like, getting at that, how do people negotiate their relationships with each other in a scholarly setting where you're supposed to be objective, but everything is infected with these weird idiosyncrasies? Your affections.
Your team affiliations.
Yeah, all of that.
What jersey you're wearing.
All that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm not, obviously I'm not insusceptible either, so you kind of have to make that move as well. Like, I don't want to be Team Hegel, but I could see how this project comes off as Team Hegel, you know.
Of course, right?
He's the centerpiece.
That's a cool thing. So your project became, like, the condition of possibility for your project got undermined as you did the project.
Right.
That means you're a thinker, right? Like, in Heidegger's terms there, right?
Sure.
Like, the seeing afresh the ambiguity that's the unspoken of your statements.
Yeah. And we all live up to Heidegger's standards.
his sloganeering standards, right. So yes. So you too could be a Nazi one.
Maybe one day. I'm still young.